Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
As for Le'Veon Bell, this time of year is the time for him to get something off of his chest. Le'Veon has got a message for all of you. A message for all of you who think that he's not focused enough, that he's not dialed in, that he's not doing the work, that he's not ready. Are you ready? Here's what he has to say about you.
Hey, real shit, bro. I'm tired of social media. I'm tired of everybody telling me, you're not focused. You only want to make music. He want to play basketball. He do everything besides play football. And let me tell y'all something. Let me tell y'all something. Everybody talking, man. I know y'all got a favorite person, a favorite athlete, your mom, your dad, whoever y'all do. So if somebody work at Target, do you think when they work from day 9 to 5, they go home and all they doing is worry about putting on the shelves? They trying to worry about what serial number's coming up? No. You think Bron is waking up, oh, he ain't having no Taco Tuesdays? Bron don't have Taco Tuesdays? Y'all think he's just whooping all day? Y'all think Beyonce waking up singing all day? She don't go to work, she don't act. She don't do nothing else taking her kids. Y'all think she's waking up singing? So y'all think it's legitimate for me to just, oh yeah, I ain't supposed to be in this airport on the escalator. I'm supposed to be running up the steps, huh? Working out. Get up these damn steps, huh? That's crazy. So guess what I'm gonna do for y'all? I'm gonna give y'all this one time. I'm guessing that's what I gotta do. The normal civilian, y'all just running, working out, not eating, not doing shit, just working out all day.
Man, this dude, this guy, that is so amazing. That is like one of the best rants ever. That is absolute gold. First of all, I can't state this clearly enough. That is incredible. Check out the vocal stylings early on when he's making fun of people who crack on him. Oh, Le'Veon, you're not focused. You only want to make music. You want to play basketball. You do everything besides play football. But then my man gets going. Then he starts to pick up steam. Quote, everybody talking. I know you've got a favorite person, a favorite athlete, your mom, your dad, whatever. Somebody who works at Target. Do you think when they work from 9 to 5, they go home and all they doing is worrying about putting bleeping bleep on the shelves? They're trying to worry about what serial numbers are coming up? No. Then he goes on, quote, you think Bron is waking up? He ain't having no Taco Tuesdays. Bron don't have no Taco Tuesdays. Y'all think he's hooping all day? You think Beyonce is waking up singing all day? She don't go to work. She don't act. She don't do nothing else with her kids. Y'all think she's waking up singing? I mean, this is amazing. And the best part of all, he's doing it on an escalator in an airport. He's moving about the country and spitting knowledge into the universe. Almost everybody who's ever been in an airport is in a fog. You know, they're looking to get through TSA, maybe get to Cinnabon or Auntie Anne's or Wetzel's Pretzels, anything they can to shove all that fat in their pie hole because there's so much stress at the airport. Not Lev. He's dropping knowledge on an airport escalator, and he even has thoughts about the airport escalator. Because according to him, some of you think that he shouldn't be on that escalator. He should be running up the steps because that would get him in better shape. And then sure enough, in the second video, he's running down the steps and he's hyping the guy on the escalator next to him who's running down the escalator. And no, this is not like Antonio Brown. Certainly not like recent Antonio Brown. Le'Veon was funny. Brown stuff, when he wanted out of Pittsburgh, wasn't funny. It was annoying and tired. None of that stuff made me laugh. This made me laugh out loud. I didn't laugh at Antonio Brown FaceTiming while doing cardio. That was weird. Normally weird is good. That wasn't good. Not in that case. Mr. Big Chest was not cool. Mr. Big Chest was not funny. Le'Veon Bell going off on an airport escalator is both. It made me laugh. And more importantly, the guy's right. I know a lot of people don't want to hear it, but there is only so much time each day that an athlete can dedicate to his or her sport. There are so many days in a year where they can do it. You can't go hard every single minute of every single day. And not doing so doesn't mean that they don't care. I'm not giving the guy a pass. I mean, that doesn't mean that you just coast on everything. But athletes are allowed to have hobbies. They're allowed to have things they like to do. They're allowed to have Taco Tuesday. They're allowed to rest. They're allowed to recover. Le'Veon does not have to be running gassers 24/7. Le'Veon does not need to be in the weight room 8 hours every single day. Not only does he not need to do it, it wouldn't be smart if he did do it. And sure, he's putting a bit of a target on his back, and if he doesn't deliver this season, he's going to hear about it. If things don't work out with the Jets, there are going to be people saying that he definitely should be missing Taco Tuesday, and he should be running up and down escalators. And when the time comes, maybe he'll own it. Maybe he won't. But right now, if your reaction to this video is to not laugh, if your reaction is to say he's giving the critics ammo and he's going to regret that, then my reaction to you is lighten up. Lighten up. That is the best use of time on an airport escalator that I have ever seen. The same people killing this guy are probably the same tools who jump on the airport people mover and just stand there, post it up on the railing, and let the escalator transporter move you to and fro. Better yet, for Lev, the only thing better would be if he started treating an airport people mover like a treadmill. Just jump on that giant conveyor belt, going the wrong way, and get some steady state cardio in. That'd be the best. I'm telling you, that thing, that rant is one of the funniest things ever. That made me laugh out loud.
You're not focused. You only want to make music. He want to play basketball. He do everything besides play football. And let me tell y'all something. Let me tell y'all something. Everybody talking, man. I know y'all got
Preach.
A favorite person, a favorite athlete.
My man, is so patient on the field. He is so patient on the field, but not afraid to cut you trolls off. I love it. J-E-T-S, Jets, Jets, Jets. He might be my favorite Jets running back ever already, based on that rant. Favorite Jets running back ever. I'm speaking of Kevin Ioli. Kevin, nice to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's good to have you, Kevin. You know, this conversation is really, really unusual in the sense that I want to have you on today to talk about Manny Pacquiao and Keith Thurman on Saturday night, and I'll get to that. But we just received word that Maxim Dadashev passed away as the result of injuries sustained on Friday night in a welterweight title eliminator fight. Kevin, when you saw that, what was your reaction? What was your reaction when you heard that news?
You know, Jim, I put a tweet out and I said, I don't know if I can do this anymore. I have covered boxing for over 30 years. My first major fight was Larry Holmes and Ronaldo Snipes, which I don't remember the year, but it was 1980 or 1981. And I've had the unfortunate pleasure to be ringside for 7 fighter deaths, including 2 in a 2-month span in Las Vegas in 2005. And it's horrible. And I feel so bad for Max, and you know it's the nature of the business. You know, it's like race car drivers, and there's certain occupations. Thankfully, this doesn't happen more often because of the incredible doctors and care that go into taking care of these fighters. But just tremendously, overpoweringly sad.
Kevin, it is so sad. I mean, it's so sad. When you tweet something like that, I mean, obviously in that moment you felt very strongly about that, but as you get further away from that, do you mean that? Do you really think that this is something that you might have to step away from?
You know, I have to sit down and think about it, Jim, because, you know, I have covered fights for a long time, and I've seen this happen, and I've seen fighters have, you know, brain injuries and whatnot, and that just bothers you, and I you know, the way I've gotten through it so far, a large part is I think of the good things that boxing and fighting has done for these fighters. And so many fighters have been saved from a lot of bad things in their life by finding boxing and having success and being able to have a normal life and not be in jail or not be on drugs or and not get killed in gang violence and that kind of thing. And so that sustains you. But when you see a good guy and a guy just trying to support his family and chase a dream pass away, it just tugs at your heart and it makes it really hard. So it's a terribly difficult time for everybody, and you know, just prayers to his family.
Prepare for your summer road trips before you head out. Visit O'Reilly Auto Parts. Simple preventative maintenance before you hit the road will ensure a safe journey during the summer months ahead. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better parts, better prices every day. Kevin Ioli joining us. You know, Kevin, it seems kind of awkward to me and kind of strange, almost hypocritical for me then to turn this line of questioning to a 40-year-old Manny Pacquiao who's still fighting, brilliantly so.
Yep.
But I don't know what the pivot is. I mean, I want to talk to you about Manny Pacquiao and have the same conversation, but I do feel kind of conflicted having this conversation. But when you go back to Pacquiao and Keith Thurman, when that fight was announced, what kind of expectations did you have for that fight?
Well, you know, I think I said this to you before the fight. I had high expectations it would be a good fight. Did I think it would be the fight that it was? No way. And the reason that I didn't think that is I didn't think Pacquiao had it in him to fight at the pace he fought for that entire fight. I mean, he came out guns a-blazing to begin the fight, and he fought that way basically the entire way through. The ninth round, I thought he took it off, you know, a little bit, you know, kind of caught a breather in that ninth round. But 10, 11, 12, my Lord, he was trying to close the show. He took a massive shot in the 11th that would have knocked a lot of guys down, and he hung in there. And, you know, Keith Thurman, give him credit. I thought Keith Thurman covered himself in glory, fought tremendously hard with a lot of determination, fought a smart fight. And, you know, the questions we had about him, does he really want it anymore? He proved that he does.
We're talking to Kevin Ioli. You know, Thurman, he may have been inactive for 2 years, Kevin, but he was undefeated. He was a champion. And I had Freddie Roach on the program last week. I'm not sure I've ever heard him more confident. In fact, to the point where he was already talking about who Manny would fight after he won that fight. And he did so before the fight. What do you make of how confident Pacquiao's camp was going into it?
Well, you know, I saw that too because I was around them quite a bit during camp and then the week of the fight. And I saw, you know, they were all – and it was all because of Manny. I mean, this was – and I said this to you on your show before the fight. He was engaged and animated in a way that I hadn't seen him in a long time. I think he did a really smart thing in camp. He and Freddie came up with this thing where Manny is one of the hardest workers I have ever seen in boxing. And then that's saying something. He and Floyd Mayweather are just remarkable in the way they push themselves. But what Manny realized is he had some lackluster fights, and it was because he was pushing too hard at 40 years old. He can still do it at 40, but he can't do it every single day like he used to do. And he said to me one day, he says, I would box, you know, I'd run in the morning 7 miles. I'd do, you know, several thousand sit-ups and other exercises. Then I'd go to the gym, and I'd box, spar 33 rounds. He goes, I'd go to sleep and get up in the morning, and I'd do it again. He said, now at 40 years old, I can't do that. So he took days off in camp, Jim. And I think that that really was paid a benefit. And Freddie saw that as he was sparring. Every day he sparred, he was sharp. And because when he needed a day off, he took it. And so I think that's why they were so confident.
We're talking to Kevin Ioli. Now, Kevin, given who he beat and given that he's 40 right now, I'm not going to say that was his best moment ever, but certainly in the conversation, where does that performance rank among the great fights in Manny's career?
I think it's right near the top. His win over Miguel Cotto. Miguel Cotto was a Hall of Famer in his prime. Cotto will be inducted in the Hall of Fame the first minute he's eligible, and Manny knocked him out. I didn't have as high opinion of Ricky Hatton, but Ricky Hatton was undefeated. A lot of people were picking Hatton to beat him, and Manny knocks him down in the first round and then knocks him out with that vicious left hook in the second round. But I think this fight is right up there with any he's ever had. Considering the quality of the performance, his age, his performance from start to finish throughout the fight, it's really one of the best he's ever had.
All right, so you pointed out before the fight that Pacquiao has been a pro for 24 years, an absolute lifer in boxing. He was talking about watching Roy Jones at the 88 yeah. Olympics. Even better, he had a reference to Livingston Bramble. Man, I loved Livingstone Bramble. He, yep. Man, he was tough. That was a tough, tough fighter. How much longer do you expect Manny to keep fighting? Could he walk off on this, or is he going to be back in the ring?
I think he's going to be back. You know, he loves this so much, and there's, you know, what it does for the Philippines, he loves. And he's able to, you know, he's built hospitals and schools and roads with money he's donated from his fight purses, which he wouldn't get any other way. And he loves being able to do that. And the adoration that people have, like, you'll laugh at this, and this happened to me in China once, but even this week at the fight, I have Filipino people come up to me all the time and are taking pictures with me because I've covered Manny for 18 years.
Wow.
And it's hilarious. In China, when he fought, I believe it was Chris Algieri. I can't remember if it was Rios or Algieri, but I think it was the Algieri fight. In the Venetian where the fight was, the arena was on the basement level, and the press conference was one escalator up. And I get up there, and there's about 500 Filipino fans waiting for Manny right there. And they saw me, and I was surrounded. And it was as if I was some star myself, and I'm taking pictures with all these people because of the adoration they have with Manny. They identify me with Manny, so they want a picture of of anybody who's close to Manny, and that is so remarkable.
Kevin, you've got a lot of good stories, but that might be your best one yet. That's that is amazing. That really is. You know, again, another really sad note in the sport of boxing, Kevin. Last week, Pernell Whitaker was struck by a car.
Yes.
And he was killed. What are your memories of Sweet Pea?
You know, Sweet Pea was, I think, one of the top 20, maybe top 10 fighters of all time. He gets a lot of credit for being one of the two or three best defensive fighters of all time with Willie Pep and Floyd Mayweather, but that underestimates his offense. The thing I've said many times talking about Sweet Pea's passing was, you know, the punch behind the back against Azuma Nelson. It showed how much in control he was. He made Nelson miss that badly, and Nelson was behind him, and Sweet Pea goes and hits him behind the back. It was just an amazing in-control fighter. He beat Chavez when Chavez was at his absolute peak, 87-0. He got robbed out of the decision, but everybody who saw that fight knows who won, including Julio. And Sweet Pea was just one of the best to ever do it. A little guy who was fearless, who would fight anybody. He would have fought a heavyweight if they would have put him in with a guy, and it was almost impossible to hit cleanly.
Kevin Ioli, my guest. Kevin, really quickly before you go, let me shift to MMA for a moment. John Jones back in the news with reports of an incident, an alleged incident at a strip club in April. Without getting into the details of what has been alleged, where is John Jones right now as a fighter and as a person?
You know, I think as a fighter, he's kind of hit a plateau. I mean, he's still the best fighter in the world, still, you know, right there. But he's plateaued. He's no longer getting any better. And you can see the downside coming. You know, I'm not saying in his next fight, but that it's coming. You know, it happens for everybody. And he's been on top for a long time. He's still an elite fighter. He's still the best in the world, in my opinion. But that's coming. As a person, you know, John is a complicated guy. You know, you wonder, what is he doing in a strip joint at this point in his life when he has two girls at home and all that? It's not illegal to go to a strip joint, and is, you know, so I hope that what he's alleged to have done is not true. You know, all it is allegations at this point. But, you know, I think it's all about decision-making for John, and he's got to make good decisions. And, you know, we'll have to see what happens. You know, we don't know what the truth is, and he deserves to be presumed innocent. But, you know, if he's guilty of it, then he's put himself, his career, in a lot of jeopardy.
John Jones, of course. And yet every time we talk about John Jones now, or every time John Jones is trending on Twitter or he's in the news, it's for all the wrong reasons and generally has nothing to do with fighting. And the latest is no different. According to reports, and I said to Kevin Ioli, I'm not going to get into everything that has been alleged, but I will right now. According to reports, Jones is facing a battery charge stemming from an alleged incident in April in New Mexico. I'd love to say that I'm surprised, but I'm not. Although it is a little surprising that his spokesperson told KRQE in Albuquerque that he didn't know about the charge until the TV station mentioned it. That is a little bit odd. Apparently, there was a bench warrant issued for his arrest after he alleged to have gone to a strip club in April. KQRE reports a waitress told police that, quote, Jones slapped her inappropriately, pulled her down to his lap, kissed her neck while she was at work. The waitress told police he also placed her in a chokehold, picked her up off the ground. When she told him to stop, he allegedly kept touching her until he decided to leave, end quote. On Sunday, he went to Metro Court. He paid a $300 cash bond. His spokesperson gave KQRE the following statement, quote, today the media told Mr. Jones about a false accusation launched against him and that paperwork had been sent to an incorrect address. However, after receiving the documents from the press, Mr. Jones immediately went to pay the small fee, and he and multiple witnesses stand ready to factually refute the malicious lies being told about him to the public. End quote. And then in response to a tweet about being in trouble again, Jones tweeted back, quote, I'm definitely not in any trouble, my friend. Don't be so quick to believe everything you read on the internet. He then chased that with, quote, I know there's a whole bunch of people hoping for my downfall, but there's even more who are proud of me and love me or love seeing me do well. And screw staying inside. I love this community. Excited to keep climbing. Haters going to be mad when I win December. Hey, nobody's saying you should stay inside, John. Just maybe don't go to a strip club. Or you know what? Better yet, stay inside. Like, we've reached this weird point in the career of John Jones. Like, there was a time, it's kind of hard to imagine, it's hard to fathom, but there really was a time when he first burst onto the scene that it was so different. He was so different. This guy was pure electricity inside and outside the cage. This was the guy who Uriah Faber glossed the Michael Jordan of MMA. He was the kind of guy who was going to meditate before a fight, but then saw a robbery in process. He ran down the robber. He restrained him until the cops came. Then he won a title that night. That was like a real thing. That happened. At that time, there was so much talk about John Jones. In fact, at that time, there was no such a thing as too much John Jones. This guy had so much it. He was amazing. He had the potential to not just be the biggest name in MMA, but the biggest name in all of sports. Do you remember that? I do. I remember thinking it. I remember saying it. I remember believing it at the time. But then again, I am the one who's constantly saying, we don't really know any of these guys. And we really don't know John Jones. Look at what he's done since then. If there's a way to wreck a reputation, he's found it. Criminal behavior, check. Recreational drug use, check. PEDs, check. And now another allegation, this time in a strip club. Again, I don't know what he did or what he didn't do in April. The whole situation does seem pretty weird and pretty strange. I'm not going to jump to any conclusions because I don't know. I wasn't there. And in the eyes of the law, he's innocent until proven guilty. But it's not like this particular guy deserves the benefit of the doubt. Not with his rap sheet, not with his track record. John Jones right now is at a point where if his name is trending or if he's in a headline, people will jump to conclusions. And they're not the conclusions that he would want people to have. And not just people like me. Fellow UFC fighter Corey Anderson didn't wait very long. He jumped right in. He tweeted, quote, "So, last week, it was his past, like he was a changed man. This morning, we see he's still the same old can't get right. From pregnant women to strippers. At Johnny Bones deserves a Grammy for his acting skills. Because he's selling the media that changed man role like Denzel. Hashtag UFC. Hashtag phony. Hashtag awesome tweet. Give him a Grammy for his acting skills is a great line. Here's the bottom line, though. John Jones is arguably the greatest to ever step in a cage. But when there's a headline involving him, it should be exciting, not cringy. But that's where he is right now. And he's got nobody to blame for that but himself. And instead of being the best to ever do it, he's just a bad actor now. A bad actor who deserves a Grammy. Give that man his Grammy. $1 million body, 10-cent head. The old proverbial line, but it's true in this case. Man, give that cat a Grammy. He's earned it. All the best actors get him. No matter how big or small your team is, Ferguson has a winning game plan for pro contractors. With thousands of plumbing repair parts, knowledgeable associates, and the largest national footprint in the game, when the pressure is on, count on Ferguson. Joe Moorhead is my guest. Joe, it's good to have you on. How are you?
Great to be back, Jim. Doing great. How are you doing?
Good, good. Good to have you back, Joe. So fall practice opens up next week, and the preparations for Louisiana in the Superdome will begin in earnest. But, Joe, before we get to that, I understand there's a big Little League tournament going on. What are those Little League games like for you as a father?
Oh, they're fantastic. And I'm a baseball guy at heart, so it's, you know, one of the times where I get to plop down my chair and kind of sit behind the screen and, you know, watch our guys play. And, you know, we win this one. We had the regionals in Waco. That'll be on ESPN. So one pitch at a time is what I'm telling them.
That's big time baseball right there. Now, I know you're a baseball guy. In fact, as long as we're on the topic, you're a big Pirates fan. And you were back in Pittsburgh recently for the 40th reunion of the 1979 Pirates team. What kind of memories do you have of that team?
I was just about six when they won that series in 79. And I can remember it vividly. Can probably recite the entire start lineup, and there was a little bit of rain delay in the game this past Saturday, and they put the they put that game seven up on the screen, and it was pretty cool when they assembled the team right prior to the game and announced all the guys, and It was just a pretty neat moment for people from Pittsburgh who followed that team.
Joe Moorhead joining us. I feel like I could do an entire interview about Little League or the We Are Family Pirates or the Curse of Oak Island. I mean, all this is a compliment. But a lot of coaches try to make it seem like they don't have lives, that they're only obsessed with college football. Joe, how important is it for you to have a life away from the game and to unplug when there's time to unplug?
Yeah, a good friend of mine who I went to high school with, who's now the defensive coordinator at Texas, Todd Orlando, we coached together at UConn the year that we went to the Fiesta Bowl. And one thing that he said to me, he said, "Hey, in this profession, you've got to take your job seriously, but not yourself. But at the end of the day, we're husbands, we're fathers. And I think that the more in tune and the more fun that you have off the field, I think the better coach it makes you, you know, when it comes time to do those things in the season."
We are talking to Joe Moorhead. That's really interesting that you got to take your job seriously, but not yourself. Now, you're coming off a season where you were ranked in the top 25. You won the Egg Bowl by 32 points. You went to a New Year's Bowl. You had the most wins at Mississippi State by a first-year head coach in nearly eight decades. You always want more, but from the outside, that seems like a really successful season. When you look back on last year, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Yeah, I think – you know, I was pleased with it, but not satisfied. Certainly, we had a very, very high-level defense, led the SEC in the country in scoring defense and total yardage. I had three guys drafted in the first round. Took some positive steps offensively. You know, there were a few games there at the beginning of the season against SEC opponents where we didn't perform to my expectation level or historically what we've done in this offensive system. But I do think we built a strong foundation, and I think, year two, everywhere I've been, we've taken a nice big jump and a major step, and I think we're poised to do that this year as well.
We're talking Mississippi State football. Joe Moorhead's the head coach. All right, so what about that second year? As you get ready for your second season, how different does it feel as compared to this time last year?
I think, the kids understand our expectation level of them, and we understand their expectation level of us. You know, coaches use the term culture, and I feel like, you know, we've taken major steps there. I'm seeing great things this summer from our leadership, our chemistry, our accountability and all those little things that matter, because we're not always going to have the most talented team. You know, obviously the SEC and the SEC West, the most, rigorous division in all of college football. And when you don't always have the most talent on your roster, you got to find a way to bridge the gap between good and great. And I think our belief in those little things is what's going to help us. And I've seen that so far this summer.
Now, Joe, there's culture, and that's critical to be sure. And then there's schemes. You've always been known for your offensive schemes. So when you're coming into a new situation with a whole new roster and you've got to install a new offense, how are you able to get the offense to where you wanted it to be last year? How'd you get it in so quickly?
Yeah, I think it's a delicate balance, Jim. And at the end of the day, I always tell our coaches, it's not what we know, it's what the players can execute. You want to make sure that you have your scheme match your personnel, not the other way around. So there are certain things that we did at Penn State and at places before that maybe we weren't able to do right away here at Mississippi State, based on who our guys are and what they were able to execute. But I think a good, strong foundation of it was built. I think we did a very, very good job running the ball. And I think for us to take the next step, we got to increase the efficiency and the explosiveness of our pass game, and I think we're going to be able to do that.
Joe Moorhead joining us. All right, so in terms of that pass game, the expectation is you'll have a quarterback battle in camp between Tommy Stevens, who arrived from Penn State, and Keaton Thompson. Rather than asking you to evaluate their strengths, what is it that you're looking for in a quarterback, and what are the signs that let you know somebody is the guy that you want to lead that offense?
Yeah, with the guys on the roster and the guys that we recruit, we say we want a quarterback who can beat you with his brain, his arms, and his legs. And I think the biggest thing outside of inspired confidence in your teammates and the belief that you're the guy to lead the team to victories, both guys are equally skilled as runners. If you look at their history, they're probably both around 8 yards a carry. So that's not going to be the thing that separates them. For us, it's going to be who throws the ball better, who makes the best decisions, who's the most accurate, who can push the ball down the field, and who can minimize turnover. So the thing throughout the course of camp and the competition that's going to lead us to a starter is who's going to be the better thrower of the two guys.
We're talking to Joe Moorhead. Now, Joe, you mentioned the defense, and you had some elite talent on defense, as you pointed out. You had three guys go in the first round, yet you're still returning a lot of talent on that side of the ball. What kind of expectations do you have for the defense this year?
Yeah, I think we're going to need to reload rather than rebuild. Bob Shoup, who was a Broyles Award finalist last year, came in from Tennessee, did an awesome job with his staff. You know, the front four, we lost Montez, Gary Green, and Jeffrey Ault of the draft, and Braxton Hoyett signed a free agent contract, as well as our three interior backups. So I think across the defensive line, we've got experience, we've got talent, we just got to get them a bunch of reps. I think our linebacking core is as good as any in the SEC or the country. and have some good returning guys on the back end. So it's going to be a matter of getting the inexperienced guys who are talented a bunch of repetitions and kind of, you know, elevating the expectation level to build off of what we did last year.
We're talking Mississippi State football. Head coach Joe Moorhead for another moment or two joining us. Now, when you and I talked about last season, this was not your first time as a head coach. You had been a head coach before when you were at Fordham before going to Penn State as the offensive coordinator. So, Joe, how did it feel to be back as a head coach?
No, it felt great. And to be able to take over Fordham, which was my alma mater, and I think we went 38-13 there and, you know, beat two FBS teams, beat Temple and beat Army. It's the same seat, but with a lot more responsibility and a lot more eyes on you. I think around the staff table at Fordham, we had 10 total people, you know, sitting in the staff room now, and there's probably 35, 40 people in there. And it means more delegation and more responsibility, but to have the opportunity to lead a group of young men to achieve things that maybe they're not capable of achieving on their own, because that's what I define as leadership. And there's no better place to do it than the SEC West. And that's why I took this job, because of the challenge of doing it against the best. We're going to do it big or we're not going to do it at all.
You bet. And Joe, one last thought. One of the differences between last year and this year is the fact that you've got a totally new physique. You dropped more than 50 pounds. And you said, quote, "I got to 295. I got tired of recruits asking where I played on the offensive line instead of how many yards I passed for as a quarterback. That was one reason, but the true impetus of it was my mom," end quote. So what did your mom say to you? And then how much did that motivate you?
Oh, well, her and my dad came down to the bowl game, to the Outback Bowl, and we got back home and he kind of got on the phone, and you know, I'm the youngest of three and she's an Italian lady from Pittsburgh. And the next thing I do wrong in her eyes will be the first thing in only a way she can. "Hey honey, I'm a little bit worried about your health. You think maybe you should start watching what you eat?" And when she said that, it was time to take a good hard look in the mirror and a good hard push away from the table and start dropping some LBS.
Hey Joe, the thing is, being a head coach is a really stressful job. I mean, there are more things to do than there are hours in the day. Between being a family man and a coach, it's easy and it's understandable to just grab whatever you can when you can, no matter what it is. But that has not been your approach. What has been your approach when it comes to diet?
Yeah, the term, I guess, is intermittent fasting, where you pick a 6 to 8 hour block of time during the day to eat. You know, I've heard that most people do it from noon to 6 or noon to 8. That allows you to get two meals. I felt like anything worth doing was worth overdoing. So I go like 6 to midnight, which allows me to eat one meal. And I don't know that I didn't do much research into it. I started doing it and it worked. So just kept it rolling.
So let me ask you, how different do you feel as a result of all this?
Now, I feel great. I used to have to walk and I'm not very fast, so I don't run. So now I'm able to jog and, you know, just don't feel like you're carrying those extra 55 pounds around with you.
Great. He's the head football coach at Mississippi State, entering his second season there. They're coming off a really, really big season. They open up against Louisiana in New Orleans on August 31st. Joe Moorhead, my guest. Joe, great to get caught up, and nice to have you back on. Thanks so much.
Great to be back.
Something I've not gotten into yet that I want to talk about is the NFL and the way it's handling its code of conduct policy and discipline. Friday, the NFL announced that Tyreek Hill would not be suspended following an investigation that started after law enforcement authorities went to his house twice in March to investigate child abuse and neglect. The Johnson County District Attorney said the charges would not be filed against Hill or his fiance, not because they didn't believe that a crime had occurred, but because they could not establish who committed that crime. Then there was the release of audio, reportedly between Tyreek Hill and Crystal Espinal. Audio which included a threat from Hill to Espinal. Then yesterday, the league announced that Seattle Seahawks defensive lineman Jaron Reed would be suspended 6 games for an incident back in 2017. If you didn't know that Reed was being investigated for an incident in 2017, you're not alone. And in that case, he was never arrested nor charged. So to quickly recap, Tyreek Hill is not punished by the league for an incident which left a 3-year-old child with a broken arm and where there is audio of him making a threat to a woman he had already pled guilty to assaulting. But there's Jaron Reed, who gets suspended 6 games for an incident where he was not arrested and was not charged. So, what was the incident from 2017 which led to Reed's suspension in 2019? According to the Seattle Times, on April 27th, 2017, police were called to a house in Bellevue at 12:49 a.m. for a noise complaint due to a party. The people at the residence said they would keep the noise down. Police were then called back at 3:06 a.m. According to the second report, Reed allegedly assaulted a woman during an argument. He, quote, grabbed her by the throat, pulled her into the connected bedroom, end quote. He then, quote, grabbed her by the right wrist and started dragging her across the bedroom floor to the staircase, going downstairs to the main floor, end quote. He then allegedly dragged her down, quote, a couple of stairs, end quote, before she managed to break away and run to a bathroom where she locked herself in and called 911. At that point, Reed allegedly broke down the door before an unidentified friend got a hold of him, told him to leave. When police arrived, they did see that the bathroom door had been broken and Reed was nowhere to be found. But so based on that police report, that sounds like a terrible situation. Based on that police report, it sounds terrible, but again, for reasons that, according to the Seattle Times, were redacted, charges were not filed. But that's not the issue here. And let me say one thing. There is something really awkward about people in sports media declaring how many games a particular violent action against another human being deserves. Like, there's no metric, there's no rule of thumb that's going to sound good. It's always going to come off sounding really stupid, really callous. When you're talking about a child suffering a broken arm, or threats made to a woman, or a woman being grabbed by the throat and dragged, to suddenly translate into a certain number of football games missed, I mean, how absurd is that? It's absurd. That said, if you want to tell me that Jaron Reed deserves a strict punishment for an incident where he dragged a woman by the throat, if that happened, I'm not going to disagree with that. But if you want to tell me Tyreek Hill gets nothing for an incident where a child suffered a broken arm, and he sure appeared to make threats to the mother of that child, then I'm going to need an explanation. And herein lies the problem. There is no explanation. Like, maybe Hill didn't receive punishment because his fiance did not cooperate with the league's investigation. Or maybe because law enforcement authorities did not provide information. But there is still the audio of the threat. It's a threat that Hill's own attorney said was, quote, unacceptable. Hill's own attorney said was, quote, inexcusable in a letter to the league. He said as much. The attorney said that. And still Hill gets nothing. Maybe there's a scenario in which the NFL is doing with discipline in these two cases that makes sense. Maybe there's a reasonable explanation, but they don't provide the explanation. And when they don't, it makes it seem like the player discipline policy is arbitrary. And the entire point of having a policy is that it's not arbitrary. It's a policy. People should not be surprised when there is no punishment. And they shouldn't be surprised when there is punishment. It shouldn't feel like flipping a coin or a guessing game. But it does, because it's not consistent. Not only is it not consistent, the league appears to be incredibly inconsistent. It seems really arbitrary and random. And that's not the point of a player discipline policy. I mean, by very definition, the point of having a policy is so it's not arbitrary. So it's a league that's been tripping all over itself, falling all over itself when it comes to player conduct, going back to Ray Rice's initial joke of a punishment. And that was 5 years ago. I'm not saying it's easy. It's not. But they've had all this time to get it right. All this time to get it to a situation where people can understand it, and that still has not happened. That's why either the league's got to outsource the discipline so it's not their issue, or just flat stop doing it. Because right now it's a mess. There's no consistency whatsoever. Like, why did Reed get six games and Hill none? Why did Ezekiel Elliott get six and Hill none? Anytime the league wants to get around to explaining that would be great, because right now nobody can make any sense of this so-called policy. And that's because it doesn't make sense, because there is no consistency. How do you know what you're going to get time to time? Does make a lot of sense. Pete Prisco is my guest. Good to have you back. Pete, how are you?
Good, Jim. How are you?
Good, good, bud. So your annual training camp tour, Pete, is already underway. Before we get to the teams that you have visited, how different is training camp right now versus the ones that you covered back in the day when Tom Coughlin was running things with Jacksonville?
Oh, night and day. Let's think about this for a second. We're in late July, okay? In 1995, his first year in Jacksonville, he took the team to Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and started training camp on July 6th. And he built in a mandatory slash voluntary mini camp to open training camp, and he had 6 weeks of practices, two a day, beat the daylights out of the team. And nowadays, these guys go out for 2 hours, and they don't hit barely at all, and off they go. It's night and day, Jim, in the changes in the NFL.
Good times. Pete Prisco joining us. So you've written that he beat the bleep out of that team. And there's no doubt that training camps back in the day were much tougher. They were much more physical. Were they more effective?
Well, they were effective because you didn't have as much off OTA days and off-the-field work in the off season. So you had to come and you had to kind of find out a little bit more about your team. Even though you don't hit in the off season, you can still figure out if a guy can play or not quickly. And I think you don't have to use training camp as much to do that. Back in the day, you know, guys would be smoking and drinking and working side jobs. And, you know, they'd show up for practice at the beginning of training camp, and they have maybe one or two mini camps, and that's it. So I think from that standpoint, it's entirely different. And then, you know, we're much more cautious now about players' bodies and what they can take and what they can't take. Two-a-days were brutal, and anybody who's ever been around the NFL back in the days of two-a-days know that it was a grind for everybody who covered, the guys who covered it, the guys who did it, and particularly the players, because they took a beating.
We're talking to Pete Prisco, senior NFL columnist for CBSSports.com. Now, Pete, you've already hit on the Broncos, and now you're with the Falcons. I'm going to ask you about the Broncos in a second, but Atlanta had big expectations going into last season, then they went 7-9. What's the vibe like around their camp right now?
Well, I think it's pretty much that they know, particularly from the front office and coaching standpoint, that this is a big year for them. I mean, they have to probably win to keep their jobs. At least I think Dan Quinn, he won't say that, but you get the idea that he feels that. And look, this is a team that had problems protecting Matt Ryan last year, and you hear rumblings that a mandate came from above that you better fix the offensive line and protect my franchise quarterback. And that's exactly what they did. They went out and spent a lot of money on the offensive line, picked up a few free agents, but then they spent big-time draft capital on the offensive line as well. So I think from a protection standpoint, it would be better, but they also want to run the ball a little bit more and take some of that pressure away from Matt Ryan, who, by the way, had a really good year last year, almost, in fact, as good as his MVP season, and kind of went quietly without much notice.
Hey, Pete, stay on that topic for a minute, because I spoke with him in Atlanta before the Super Bowl. And when he came on the show, I thought that he was more confident, more comfortable than I'd ever seen him before. You know, to listen to you right now, and I know this already, you're a big believer in him. What is it about him that makes him special in your mind?
Well, he understands the passing game, for one. I mean, he knows how to go through his progressions. He knows how to get to, you know, from one to two to three and then dump it down. But more than that, he's a tough guy. I mean, you know, that's one thing. And in talking even last week with John Elway, one of the things that people underestimate in the value of a quarterback is being able to stand there and there take the shot. And he's taken plenty of them. I mean, you know, the middle of their line at times during his career has been bad. Last year they played six guards. They had rotation of guards in there, and he took a beating. So firm that up, and he's going to be able to even put up bigger numbers. Somebody asked me today, if he goes out and wins another MVP and wins a Super Bowl, would Matt Ryan be a Hall of Famer? And I had to hesitate for a second. If he won another MVP, that would give him two. If he won a Super Bowl, it'd be his first, and then he came within a whisker of winning another one, he'd certainly be in the conversation.
We're talking to Pete Prisco. All right, Pete, keep it in the NFC South for a minute. There's been some level of chatter that Drew Brees might be regressing. What is your reaction when you hear that?
That's absurd. I don't buy that one bit, and I'll tell you why. And I was down there a couple weeks ago and talking to Sean Payton. He laughed at that notion. And part of that is because they're a different team now than they used to be. They don't have to throw the ball around as much. They don't have to rely on him as much. The defense was better last year. So, I disagree with that wholeheartedly. I think if you still need to have a quarterback who can go make plays when they need to, can get the big points late in the fourth quarter, Drew Brees can do that. And I don't think he's regressing at all.
All right, so the Saints, Peter, coming off their second straight postseason where they had just a gut-wrenching ending. What's your sense as to how they're dealing with the pain of losing to the Rams?
You know, it's interesting because in talking with Sean Payton, he said, look, they've done some hokey things in the past to try and get past the season. One being they had a funeral on the back of their practice field and buried some artifacts from the year before. And then they dug them up when they went on a losing streak early because they thought it was a reverse curse on them. So, you know, this year he's just kind of going out and he realizes, look, they had a tough loss. They got to get past it. It's 2 years in a row. And that challenges a coach and it challenges a team because they had that loss in Minnesota that was a gut wrencher as well. So for me, I think Sean Payton is in a perfect spot to try and get that team past it. And when I was there, they really weren't talking much about it.
All right, so going back to the Broncos now, Pete, John Elway had some problems resolving the quarterback situation, has had them since Peyton Manning retired. Do they have the solution now in the combination of Joe Flacco in the short term and Drew Locke in the long term?
I would say in the short term, Joe Flacco can get them to 9-7, 8-8 in this offense. I think it fits what he wants to do. They want to, you know, he played in it under Gary Kubiak and had his best season when he threw 27 touchdown passes in Baltimore. So he's comfortable with the offense. It's the same terminology. He will be fine, and I think he plays the entire season. Drew Locke is a guy I like coming out of school, and in talking to John Elway, he really liked him. But he struggled a little bit early on to pick up the offense. He struggled, you know, with accuracy at times. And you don't know if that's a product of being so early in camp or if it's a product of he's going to need a lot of work. But I think this year, for me, it's all about Joe Flacco. And then moving forward, I think Drew Locke is the quarterback of the future.
And then obviously, Pete, they're in a tough division. For instance, the Chargers have a lot of talent on both sides of the ball. If Melvin Gordon is there, do you make the argument that they're the favorites in the AFC West, or is that still Kansas City's division?
No, I think the Chargers are the favorite, and Chiefs fans won't like to hear that, and I love Patrick Mahomes. I think he's a star of stars, and they do have a ton of offensive weapons, including Tyreek Hill, who surprisingly will be there for the entire season. But I'm still concerned about the defense. I know they're switching to a 4-3, and they've made some changes on that unit. But I think, all in all, I think the Chargers are the most talented team, top to bottom, with Melvin Gordon. Now, having said that, it'll be interesting to see if they pay him. I'm talking to people around the league. You know, some say that they won't, and nor they should they. I mean, the running back market has been devalued, and paying him a big money deal will really challenge the Chargers if they indeed do that. But I do think the Chargers are the best team in that division.
So, Pete, on that topic, where do you come out? Like, what was your reaction to the idea that Gordon might hold out, and how do you see it going?
I think they'll restructure it. I don't think they're going to give him a mega deal that he's looking for. And in large part, all they have to do is look over across town to Todd Gurley. I mean, Todd Gurley got the big deal. And then Todd Gurley hasn't been the same player, A, because of injuries, and B, you know, maybe some other things. You know, there were some people that were concerned that his mental side wasn't very good in the championship game after he had a ball bounce off his hands and get intercepted. So I think, you know, Gurley, everybody applauded him from the running back position when he got that contract, but now that might be working against those guys because if you look around, C.J. Anderson went in and he was fine. And in other spots, guys have gone in. Look what happened in Pittsburgh, Le'Veon Bell. Connor isn't Le'Veon Bell, but he wasn't far off him. He was a lot cheaper. So I think that Gurley contract is actually going to end up hurting some of the running backs.
So, Pete, also, what about Ezekiel Elliott? Like, these teams have done pretty well. The teams that you mentioned have done pretty well without those bell cow backs, at least in the short term. Will Dallas take care of Ezekiel Elliott because they've got Dak Prescott and Amari Cooper as well, obviously?
Yeah, and I think if I was prioritizing those three, I would go number one, Dak Prescott, without question. I think the quarterback position is more valuable. But having said that, he's not a better player than Elliott. Elliott's a better player at his position than Prescott is at his. But the value of the quarterback position, as you know, is just so much bigger and stronger than a running back position that I think they have to prioritize it that way. But I do think Elliott gets done, in large part because I think Jerry Jones, very loyal to him, loves the kid. The kid loves Jerry Jones. We know they're a run-centric team, and I do think Elliott will get done.
Matt in L.A., you know he's got an idea. Matt's got lots of ideas. Matt, what's up?
What up, Romy A.? From Hawthorne to Hong Kong, from Gardena to Galveston, you're welcome. Hey, I think who you should have on that 100 podcast, let's make it symmetrical. You had a Dodger as 5-0, so let's go with the Dodger 100, Chick Pumping Garv. I want to know about all the debauchery that was happening in the 70s Dodgers when they were rolling to continuous NLCSs and lighting up the town. Want to know about Fernando Mania firsthand, all that good stuff, Romy. And if not, I'll definitely take our dude with the Krispy Kremes, Delonte West, because I've always wanted to know, man, what was the real story between him and the Queen, James, if you know what I mean.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Hey, Matt, does that seem like a pretty good idea? Like, how would that line of questioning go, Matt? Hey, Garv, really good to have you on. Hey, let me ask you something, Six. What was it like pumping all those chicks? Is that what you're asking me to do, Matt?
Good night now!